Good afternoon. So last time, we looked at using monitors. We had briefly introduced them before. We looked at how we could actually use this to solve our general problems of we want to wait for something to happen. And generally, we used this lock for access to some shared data. And this shared data would include, whatever information was tracking what we were waiting for. So in our producer-consumer example, the information was the buffer, and in particular, how much stuff was in the buffer and how much space was free. And we'd have a loop where while some condition that was based in the shared data, was true, we'd wait if we wanted to wait for that condition to become false. To make this wait operation work, we needed to have the code that would change that condition. So in the producer-consumer example, that would add or remove things from the buffer and therefore change its size or how much stuff in it's used, either broadcast or signal. So broadcast is generally just that we say, okay, we're going to make everyone who is waiting recheck the condition. We can use signal if we know that, well, even if there's multiple threads waiting, only one of them is going to be able to act on this change to the condition, which happened to be true in the producer-consumer example, but in more general cases might not be true. Like if you think of using this to implement that pthread join idea, or I guess pthread join isn't the right case because you can only join a thread once, but if we think of like waiting for a thread to be finished, then, well, we want everyone who's waiting to stop, not just one of those threads. Everyone's going to be able to take advantage of the condition change. And we mentioned that, well, maybe you care about who gets signaled or who gets broadcasted. How can you deal with that? And the strategy we mentioned is that you can have basically a more specific condition. We gave one example of that by just making a separate condition for each thread, but we can do things in between, and we'll see an example of that later today when we talk about reader-writer locks. We talked about how monitors deal with handing off the lock to a thread that gets signaled or broadcasted to, and we mentioned that there were sort of two options. There were this MESA-style option versus this HOR-style option. So MESA-style monitors say that, that if you signal a thread and therefore wake it up, that doesn't mean it actually gets to run right away. In particular, something else might get the lock next. Whereas alternatively, we could kind of integrate our condition variables, our list of waiting threads, and the lock, and sort of hand off the lock to the next thread. But MESA style, where that doesn't necessarily happen, is easier to implement, and therefore the most common implementation you will see by a large margin. And this means that even if we didn't have to worry about those spurious wake-ups, about wait, just sometimes when it's inconvenient for us, just not waiting, we'd still need that while loop instead of an if loop, because sometimes we're going to have occasions where we were signaled, but someone else did something before we actually woke up that changed that condition back to something we want to keep waiting for. As I alluded to, we looked at specifically producer-consumer with monitors, and that's sort of an example of this case. And our condition, here was whether the buffer was empty or full. Depending on whether you're looking at the producer side or the consumer side. So there's a question, is what is an example of something that would cause the thread that was signaled not to run next? So in a MESA-style monitor implementation, often the way the monitor implement, the wait implementation might work is that cond wait will do something like add to wait list, then unlock the lock. So it's we have a wait list and then call the scheduler. then lock the lock. And that would be the conwait implementation. So if this is what that implementation looks like, then the signal operation will cause the thread to start running here. And that means that there's this period of time when the thread is running and is trying to acquire the lock. And while that's happening, some other thread might come in and lock the lock first and do something and unlock the lock before this thread, after it returns from the scheduler, gets to relock the lock. So the other style of monitor implementation would prevent this from happening by having something other than this lock operation happening in the conwait implementation, but it would like be done on behalf of the thread before it gets to run again. Does that answer that question? Okay. So that was about monitors. And last time we also started covering our next topic, which we should finish up today, which was what I'll call counting semaphores. I just introduced them as semaphores. I'll explain briefly today why I'm prefixing this with counting. So a counting semaphore that holds a non-negative integer, and it has two operations, which we mentioned that these have tons of names. The two names we're going to use, we're going to use pairs of names for the first operation, we're going to call either down or wait, and that decrements the integer, but since it's non-negative, it waits for it to be positive first. So it decrements it, and this is atomic, so if like two threads are crawling down, one of them is going to go first, then the other. We're never going to let the integer become negative. And the up operation increments the integer, and this might make someone who's calling down actually finish. And we saw the example with a library book, sort of where a library has, you know, so many copies. We could track the number of copies with a semaphore, and the down operation would be like reserving one of them. And, well, we can't reserve yet if there's not any available yet, so we'll wait for something to be available to reserve, and up or post is putting back one. Now, up or post, like, lets someone stop waiting. And when we finished up last time, we looked at, the semaphores, this seemed like a very different abstraction, but it's going to turn out that semaphores and monitors do all the same things. And to start illustrating that, we looked at how we could translate the idea of these semaphores to locks, and we saw that we could do that by having a semaphore where basically the integer represents, how many locks are available, and you call down to get a lock, which means there's now no locks available, and you call up to put one back, which means now there is a lock available. And using this, we could use a semaphore to implement basically a mutex. So questions about semaphores or lingering questions about monitors before we move on and look a little more at semaphores today? Okay, so we saw this idea of implementing our basic mutex lock operation, and we can also implement sort of our basic wait for something to happen operation. So we can do basically what thread join would do, is wait for a thread to finish, where what we'd say is that we'll start this semaphore at zero, and basically, when the semaphore represents how many times you can join it without waiting. And we're going to say that when the thread finishes, we're going to increment that count. And when we want to join it, we're going to wait for the thread to finish by trying to decrement that count. If it's zero, because the down operation waits, we're going to wait. If it's one, we're not. And so this achieves that waiting operation. And this tells us, in some sense, that semaphores, even though it's one abstraction, kind of give us both the functionality of locks and condition variables in some way. Now, it may not be clear yet how we would implement sort of everything we might want to do with condition variables. But I assure you, and we're probably not going to go into sort of the proof, but semaphores are powerful enough to implement everything that we can do with condition variables. And this sort of gives you an idea of like why we can do the wait for something to happen operation that condition variables allow. So questions about this join implementation? Okay, so POSIX has semaphores, and the naming doesn't follow what you might have guessed based on everything we've seen before. It's not doesn't start with pthread. So we have this semaphore header. The semaphore type is a semt. And there's this seminit function. It takes this extra argument called process shared. So it turns out we can use semaphores between processes. You might say, wait a moment. But that means we need to have two processes with the pointer to the same thing. How do we do that? We'll get to there when we talk about virtual memory. But for now, you know, we could just leave this as zero for false. And the seminit takes an initial value for the semaphore, the initial integer that it's going to store. And POSIX uses the names wait for down and post for up. So with that in mind, let's do a little usage exercise. So I have here a value, and I have these two semaphores, and I'm going to implement this idea where that get value is going to wait for me to call put value. And when I call put value, you know, that's going to wait for a call corresponding call to get value. So basically, if we have two threads, one calling put value, one calling get value, they'll sync up at that call. That's what we want to achieve here. And that we can do this with two semaphores. So, give another 20 seconds or so. Okay, so a majority of you have chosen B, which is says that we put semwait for ready here, and then we post to empty here. And so what that's going to mean, and I believe that's the right answer. So I have that on a separate slide. So let's think about what happens here. So when we call semwait, this is like, this is saying we're waiting for a prior call to get to finish. And we call this semPost here. We're allowing a call to get to continue. So we can kind of think of these as pairs here. And so that's part of what works. Where the wait, you know, is waiting for a corresponding post to happen, potentially. Now, I've showed you here, we have the code that you figured out, and I guess I should probably address the most popular wrong answer, which is sort of ordering these things differently. So why can't we swap these two? And what I like to think about is that we need to make sure that when we read value, it's already been written. So we want to make sure that this post is after the value is written here. Therefore, the wait should be before we read the value. So if we swap these two, this wait and post operation here, which was option A, then we're going to end up possibly reading the value before it gets written. So questions about this solution? Okay, so let's do the second part, which is I haven't shown you how to initialize these semaphores, and we have to specify an initial value. So what should that be? So presumably there's some code, you know, that's going to call before this all runs. Empty, some value, and the same thing for ready. So what should that be? And something I like to think about when reasoning about what these values are is, like, what are we counting here? So can we give a name for what's being counted? In this case, our counts are going to end up being pretty trivial as far as, like, their values, but there's something being counted, and that's how we can, like, reason about both, you know, whether we're setting the counts right and whether we're, you know, calling wait and post at the right time. Like, did we actually change the thing that's being counted? So I'll give another 15 seconds or so. Looks like maybe less than that. It looks like I have pretty good consensus on an answer. Okay. So the majority answer is that our empty should be 1, and our ready should be 0. So one way of reasoning about this is that we don't want a get value to work until after a put value has happened. So the first wait in get value should wait if it's called without anything else happening, which means that ready, which it's waiting on, should start at 0. Because calling get value without doing anything else should just wait. Should wait before doing anything. Like, that we shouldn't, like, even try to retrieve the value until put value runs. So we can similarly say, okay, so put value should write the value before get value reads it. So this means that this, the corresponding empty variable, can't start at 0. And this gives a question of what is it counting, and it's counting the number of values we can put, is what I put. So this should start at 1. And, you know, because we want to be able to put value right away. one or more, be able to put a value right away. And it should not start at, and it can't start at 2 because we don't want to be able to put two values without taking terms. So as far as like, what are these counting? So what I would say then is empty is counting the number of slots to put a value in, and ready is counting the number of slots with a value. And with that sort of reasoning, that would be another way I could arrive at these answers. I could say, well, initially there's one place to put a value, this value variable, and no values are ready. So empty is 1, ready is 0. And I can look at this code and verify that it obeys this constraint. I can say, when we put a value, first we reserve the value by using the down, the wait operation, to make the number of empty slots go down. And after we fill the value, we say that there's an additional ready value. For get value, first we reserve a ready value, decrementing the number of ready entries. And then we, after we retrieve the value, we say there's an additional slot to put a value in. We increment the empty value. And I can sort of verify that these waits and posts make sense. And this is sort of a strategy I might use, you know, as the general pattern for how I'll think about using semaphores. So questions on how this reasoning applies to this example, or anything else about our solution here? So when I'm writing code that uses semaphores, this is how I try to think about it. I say, what can I count that's going to be 0 when I need to wait? So I write down what that is I'm counting, and then I just figure out, where does this thing I'm counting change? And, you know, sometimes it's a bit tricky. Like, we want to count the number of threads that can start a critical section now. That's how I can think about this count, is that it's 1 if a thread can start running a critical section, 0 otherwise. And we can think of, when we lock, we decrement the number of threads that can start running a critical section. When we unlock, we increment it. So we can think about this example using that same framework. Similarly, the number of threads that can join without waiting, and so on. And we can also use this idea to implement our producer-consumer example. So I'll go through that next. And our producer-consumer example is basically an extended version of that exercise. You know, remember, what we wanted to do is we wanted to wait, have the consumer wait if the buffer is empty, the producer wait if the buffer is full. So I can track two different counts. So one count is the number of slots that are used and available to consume. So this is available slots to consume, and we'll use this to implement the consumer waits if it's empty. If there's no available slots to consume, we want to wait. And another is the available slots to produce into. And we also are going to need a lock to avoid accessing this, our, you know, shared buffer here for multiple threads, because we mentioned that typically if, like, we're resizing it, we're going to have to worry that we can't safely, you know, be reading the from this buffer while it's being potentially resized, or we can't write to it while we're writing to it from another thread, which is probably the bigger concern here, actually, is that if we have two producers, we need to make sure they take turns. And we have two consumers, we need to make sure they take terms in, like, figuring out what to take off the buffer. So this gives some code like this, that our producer will wait for a slot to be freed up by consumer if necessary. And then it will use the mutex to enqueue an item, making sure no one else is enqueuing or dequeuing so you don't get confused about where in the buffer we are. And then it will tell the consumers that they can stop waiting. And the consumer is just sort of the opposite of this, that it will wait for one of the producers to have a slot available and then tell them, now there's a slot that's free in the buffer and you can go. And here, no, I'm dealing with like a fixed size buffer. We'll get to like what could we do if it wasn't fixed sized a little later. So, questions about the strategy I have here. So, something worth noting is, you know, that so there's some things I've done here where you might be tempted to say, we have some freedom to change the order of things. And one place you might look is that, oh, we're waiting and we're waiting. Like, could we reorder this? And well, what would happen if we did that? So, we need to think about that. And the answer is that we couldn't do that. And this is kind of a subtle thing, because if we actually like swap the order here, it would often end up just accidentally working. But the problem is that we could get this mutex and that could prevent a consumer that was here from getting the mutex, and therefore the consumer would never actually call the post operation to let us actually enqueue something. So one thing that's kind of different here with these semaphores versus what the sort of patterns we've seen with monitors is that, you know, our wait operation doesn't just release a lock. That's not what we're going to do. And that kind of our wait operation is coupled with the bookkeeping that accounts for, you know, the thing, the shared data. Okay. So I can't reorder there, but I could reorder these operations. Well, I shouldn't draw the arrows like that. I could like swap these operations and that wouldn't have any effect, however. And what's the reason why? Well, the post operation never waits. It just signals things, and there would be no harm to reordering these two operations because they both just wake up threads, and we could wake up the threads in any order because we've already done any work that would interfere with shared data that they're using. Okay. So questions about this producer-consumer code? Okay. Okay, so that's sort of producer-consumer, and that combined with sort of our general intuition sort of gives you an idea about, you know, sort of how we can just use semaphores to solve all sorts of problems. I'm going to show sort of one other pattern which comes up a bunch with semaphores that can deal with some cases where you might say, I can't really have a count because, you know, there's a variable number of things. And to introduce that, I'm going to mention that, you know, the reason why when I showed my introductory slide here, I said we're dealing with counting semaphores. You might say, what's the other kind of semaphores? So there's something called a binary semaphore. And a binary semaphore is a semaphore that is only 0 or 1. And you might say, well, these seem a lot simpler, but a lot less powerful than these counting semaphores. And they are simpler, but they're not less powerful. They're, in fact, exactly as powerful. You can use a set of binary semaphores to do absolutely everything you can do with counting semaphores. I'm not going to go into the detail of how that works for time reasons, but they're exactly as powerful. And you might say, well, why is that possible? And there's a pattern that comes up a lot with semaphores that's, you know, kind of most natural for these binary semaphores, which is useful also for counting semaphores, which is this kind of gate pattern that we can do something where we, you know, keep our own track of how many threads there are, and we can let threads go one at a time. So we can say have this wait operation, which calls wait on this gate semaphore, and we post to the gate semaphore to let one thread go. And rather than trying to keep track of, say, the number of slots in a buffer, we can keep track of, is there another thread waiting or not? And, you know, if we have some way of figuring that out, we can just keep saying, okay, as long as there's another thread waiting, let's increment this gate semaphore to let another thread go. So the key idea here is that, you know, we can do, you know, can do own tracking of how many threads are waiting. And so this sort of flexibility is why semaphore, you know, why we can, like, do types of waiting with semaphores that might not seem to naturally fall into that counting a number of things pattern. This also is why, you know, or I guess the sort of strategy we might use to, say, implement condition variables with semaphores, which we can do, which is why I say you can do everything we can do with monitors with semaphores. We can use the idea of that, well, if we really needed to, we can just track which threads are waiting explicitly and use a construct like this to wake them up. So any questions about this gate pattern? Okay, so I kind of introduced semaphores as, like, an afterthought and, you know, spent more of my effort talking about monitors, and that's kind of following what our textbook did. It's not what everyone who teaches OS thinks is the right thing. So, for example, when Grimshaw teaches, he usually thinks that semaphores are the big thing you should teach, and monitors are sort of less interesting. They're equally powerful, so they're both valid ways of doing any sort of thing you might want to do for synchronization. They're just very different abstractions, and you might find one more or less natural than the other. Now, Anderson Dahlin says, well, yeah, they're equally powerful, but Anderson Dahlin says very explicitly that they think that locks and condition variables, that is, monitors, are superior. I'm not sure I agree with them, but their argument, and it's worth thinking about because it kind of illustrates, you know, how we need to think about semaphores versus monitors, is that, you know, locks and condition variables, we have separate constructs for the waiting operation and the critical section operation. Whereas with semaphores, these are kind of glommed together, and when we look at our semaphore using code, we kind of have some semaphores which are taking the duty of do one thing at a time, and some which are taking the duty of let's wait for some condition. And Anderson Dahlin argues that it would be clearer if there was more explicit separation between these two roles. So another thing Anderson Dolan doesn't like is that because the Sound Force keep track of this count, we have to be very careful about verifying that we kind of match every up or post call with a wait call. And monitors kind of allowed us to be a lot sloppier, that we can just say, okay, I changed something, let me broadcast. And that's going to at least be functional because we kind of had this double checking of the condition, whereas we have to arrange things, you know, carefully matching up those post and wait calls with semaphores. And when we can't do that directly, we end up using this kind of pattern where we have to do some bookkeeping of our own to like figure out how many people do I need to wake up, whereas with a condition variable, we just say, let's wake everyone up by broadcasting or something like that. Okay. So, talked about semaphores and monitors, and these were sort of very general constructs which allow us to do all sorts of synchronization. And now I'm going to talk about one very, very specific synchronization problem that comes up a ton, and we're going to look at a abstraction that would be really useful for this and how to implement it with monitors. And this is a problem where we have some shared data and we want to have it so only one thread modifies it at a time, but multiple threads can read it. And this is a problem that comes up in, for example, with our shared container. So if we have like a vector, the rule is that we can only have one thread, say, modifying this vector at a time, but it would be nice if we could have multiple threads reading from it at the same time. And if we just used a lock before we access this vector, well, that wouldn't work because we would not have multiple threads reading. We'd have them be taking turns, and that would be unnecessarily slow. And you might say, okay, so let's only use a lock when we're modifying. Well, in that case, the reading threads could access while it's being modified, and that would be wrong too. So we want something kind of in between. We want a kind of special kind of lock, and that's what we're going to provide. And there's something that's commonly known as a reader-writer lock. So this is kind of like a lock, but we have two types of lock operations. We have a read lock operation and a write lock operation. And the read lock operation is going to wait until there are no writers. So we can have multiple threads acquire a read lock at a time. So the read lock, you know, can be shared with any number of reading threads, you know, by any number of readers. So any number of threads can get a reader, and the write lock can't be shared. That it's one thread at a time, and that it means that there can't be any readers at the same time either. So that means our read lock waits until no one's writing. Our write lock waits until no one's reading or writing. And our read unlock and write unlock sort of unregister us as a reader or writer, so someone who's calling read lock or write lock can stop waiting. And this way I'm expressing it here, I've chosen this way of describing these operations because we can actually look at these descriptions and kind of map them very naturally to a condition variable based implementation, which I'll get to in a bit. But first, let's sort of review what these look like and also talk about sort of actually using this. So we're going to talk about how you would implement this, but if you actually want reader writer locks, well, threading libraries provide them. So POSIX has a RWLockT, which has a read lock and a write lock operation. There's an unlock operation, which doesn't care what type of lock you used previously. Basically, the lock remembers what your thread last did. Okay, so given that, let's make sure we see if we understand. So a question is, I talked about vectors. Wouldn't reading at memory size changes be an issue? Yes. So the way reader-writer locks will prevent that is any sort of change that we consider that would interfere with reading will consider a write operation. So even if conceptually you aren't changing the element being read, you still have a writer lock if, you know, you were like reallocating the array that was stored in or something. You still need a writer lock and therefore prevent readers from going. And so the example here, I should be more explicit. This is that let's assume these are all different threads running this at the same, running these pieces of code at the same time. And conceptually, what we'd imagine is happening is that in these dot, dot, dots for A through C, they're reading from some shared data structure, and the dots for D, or sorry, for A and B, they're reading, and for C and D, they're writing to a shared data structure. And writing could be very broad. That could include, like, deleting things, resizing it, or changing elements. You know, the important thing is that we're maintaining this property that if someone's writing, no one gets to read. Okay, so give another 30 seconds or so. Okay, so we have great consensus that one is possible and three is possible. Well, less consensus that three is possible. So let's first go over. So one, I'll go over quickly, is that A goes, then B goes, then C goes, then D goes. And that could just happen if, you know, they happen to be scheduled by the scheduler in that order. So how about three? This is just C goes, then A and B go together, but because it's a read lock, they can have that at the same time. The read lock just means that no one can write while we have a read lock, so A has its read lock, which overlaps with B, but that's fine. Read locks can be shared between multiple readers. And then D goes. So one and two are both fine. Three are both fine. Then the next most popular answers were two and five. So let me talk first about two. So two is not possible. And the reason why is that we're saying that C acquires the write lock and then D acquires the write lock. And that's not possible because that would mean that D and C could write at the same time. And we want the property that for writing, we take turns that only one person gets to write at a time, and while they're writing, no one else can read or write. And this violates that property because D can write while C is writing. And the next most popular is five. So five is also not possible. And the problem is that C here is writing while and A gets to read in the middle of that, and the writer lock is supposed to prevent that. And finally, we have four. Here, this is also not possible for the same reason as 2, that we have this overlap where D gets to write, but while C is also writing. Which is not allowed. Okay, so questions about how I figured out those answers? So we see that these locks maintain that property, and we're going to now construct them with monitors, keeping, you know, using sort of these descriptions to make our monitor conditions. So how do I do that? Well, I'm going to go through. I want a monitor, so I'm going to have a mutex to protect my shared data, and I'm going to need to do some bookkeeping. And if I look at my conditions, I wanted to do something when there were no readers and no writers. So to handle that, I'm just going to track in a variable the number of readers and writers. And I had these two conditions. I wanted to wait for there to be no writers or there to be no readers or writers. So I'm going to make a condition variable to have a list of threads waiting for each of these conditions to become true. And then my code, so I have my read lock operation. I need to wait for the condition that there are no writers. And I've decided that that's going to be my okay to read condition variable. That's my list of threads waiting to read. And that corresponds to there being no writers. So I wait while there's any writers. I keep waiting. And when a writer is done, it's going to broadcast there to say, okay, now there's no writers. So you might say, why didn't I have a check if writers equals zero? So this would be just redundant because I know that there can only be one writer at a time. So I know writers is always zero. All right. Okay. Similarly, I have a condition of readers and writers are zero. So no one else is reading or writing. You know, while that's not true, I wait if I'm a writer. And when does that change? Well, if we finish writing, then we know there's no readers because we aren't allowed to have readers while we're writing. So I signal that in that case. And why do I signal? Well, because I know that we're going to increment writers. So the first thread that wakes up from this wait is going to prevent the next thread from going. So that's why it's okay to signal and not broadcast here. And similarly, for read unlock, I know sometimes I'll get down to zero readers. And I know there's no writers because writers can't go while we're reading. And when that happens, I can also signal. And in this case, we see a first example where there's two different ways we can make this condition true. So questions about my code here. How this implements our reader-writer lock. And you can see that this general strategy, it kind of like might remind us of our mutex lock implementation with spin locks we saw earlier, that I'm implementing this higher level lock-like thing using a lower level, simpler mutex lock to protect our important data, which is our bookkeeping information and our list of waiting threads. So there's something about this, which is maybe, okay. So there's a question in read unlock, don't we also need, why don't we have n and writer equals zero? So I could absolutely have writer equals zero. But I know because I was just reading that there can't, so this would be also would be redundant because I know no there were no writers because I was just reading. Another thing worth noting is that if we signal too often, that's just bad performance. It's not going to make the result wrong because, like, let's say I just signaled regardless of whether readers was zero. In that case, we just wake up this write lock thread more often than we should, but it wouldn't actually finish the lock too often, at least. So we kind of limited in how bad things can be if we get these if conditions to be more generous as far as when they signal than they should be. Now, something that might be unsatisfying about this implementation we're going to talk about specifically is that on a write unlock, we signal writers and readers. And if someone's waiting for a read lock and a write lock, there's two different threads waiting for both types of locks, you might say, well, who goes first? And you might say, well, the writer goes first because you signal them first. But the answer is no, because remember, the order in which you're signaled doesn't mean you necessarily get the lock next, because we're using this Mesa-style monitors. So we just wake them all up and they fight, basically. Whoever manages to get there first gets the lock. So this is not actually particularly efficient, and you might say, can we do better than this? And the answer is yes. And in doing better than this, we can also make a decision here. So right now we've just said, we're going to let whatever the scheduler ends up doing happen, but maybe we're not satisfied with that. And in particular, we might be worried that, say, you know, if we have a bunch of writers, then they'll prevent us from ever reading, or if we have a bunch of readers, they'll prevent us from ever writing. So you might want to make an explicit decision to avoid either of those two problems. So how do we make that explicit decision? And we can kind of see a hint of the idea in that, well, if we could track who's reading and writing, we can also track who's waiting. So we can just track, in the same way we track the number of readers and writers, the number of waiting readers and writers. So here I'm going to say track the number of waiting writers. It's initially zero. And while we're waiting, we're going to increment that number of waiting writers. And this allows us later on, when someone is releasing a write lock, to use that information to decide whether to wake up a writer or wake up all the readers. Now, there's a bit of a subtlety here. And that's with my read lock condition. So why did I change my read lock condition? So why was that necessary? And a way we can think about this is that if, you know, I finish writing and I signal a writer, I don't want some reader that starts at the same time to win over that writer. I want it to be the case that if you're waiting to write, you get to go next. And a way I can think about this is that the read lock, you know, is rather than it being wait, so previously it was wait until no writers, we've now, to implement this priority, we've set it, changed it from wait until no writers to wait until no writers or and no waiting writers. This also means we've made it the case that if we have a bunch of overlapping reads, you know, it previously might be the case there'd be no time in here when, because, you know, if this is our read lock, read unlock, read lock, read unlock from different threads, there might be no time in here in which a writer could normally go. By having this, adding this additional clause to the read lock condition, we ensure that, you know, when some writer starts waiting, say here, that this reader here doesn't get to go right away. So the writer can be can get a chance to fit in. So I've made this deliberate change to the read lock condition, which is reflected in who I signal and broadcast, but also is reflected in when the read lock waits. That we know if that there's a waiting writer, it should get to go next, not a reader. And so that's going to be reflected here. So questions about the code I have here and this idea of explicitly tracking who's waiting in order to make our decision. So if we look at how this works, so I can give sort of an example of what this would look like. Well, let's say we have a reader, then another reader, then a writer, then a reader. And this is the order they come in with. Let's look at how the operation works. And remember, we're doing this bookkeeping where we're tracking the number of writers, readers, and waiting writers. And initially that's zero. Then our read lock starts, and it's going to look at the number of writers, say that's zero, number of waiting writers is zero, and it's going to say, okay, they're both zero, so I'm going to increment the number of readers and start reading. The second reader comes along, it's going to do the same thing. Writers is zero, waiting writers is zero, increment the number of readers, and keeps going. Then this write lock comes along, and it's going to say, okay, it's going to register itself as a waiting writer, so that's reflected there, and it's going to say, are there, I need there to be no other writers or readers. Well, that's not true because there's readers, so it's going to start waiting. And a read lock is going to come along, and it's going to start waiting because of that waiting writers condition. So that waiting writer's condition is going to make this new reader start waiting, even though we have other readers going on at the same time. We're going to have it hold back so this writer gets a chance to go. That's the decision we've made in this design. So eventually, this first reader finishes. That decrements our reader count to zero, but it's not zero to one, rather. It's not zero yet, so we don't do anything special. Then when we decrement it to zero, we're going to signal a writer to go. And that will finally wake up this writer. It will double check that there's in fact no readers or writers. Why do we need to do that? Well, maybe there would have been, a writer two that squeezes in right here and gets a write lock. We want to make sure that didn't happen. And we're going to register ourselves as a writer. And then when we finish, we're going to say, oh, no one else is waiting to write. And we're going to finally wake up this last reader. So questions on anything that went on in this timeline here? Okay, so in this design, we've made the decision that, okay, we're going to wait. We're going to track the number of waiting writers and use that to give priority to writers by adding this condition that, we wait until there aren't waiting writers in some cases. And we can follow the same idea to give priority to readers. So we can say, okay, we're going to track the number of waiting readers and, we're going to have the write lock wait until no one's waiting to read or reading before it gets to go, so the writers don't get to monopolize the lock. So this is another choice we could make in our design. So let's do a last little exercise on reader-writer locks. So let's say I wanted to do something in between, that I'm going to start with my reader priority here, but I want something where rather than it being, they're waiting until there's no waiting readers, I want to wait until there's no waiting readers with the exception that the readers can wait if I've waited more than a second. So where would we make changes to do that? Give another 20 seconds or so. Seems like this is a point. There's not consensus here on pretty much anything. Now, maybe what I've written down will give some hints. So I need to talk about this. Okay, so the way I like thinking about this is that previously our writing condition was that we wanted to wait until there were no readers or writers and no waiting readers. And we've changed that to we want to wait until there's no readers or writers and either no one's waiting to read or we've waited too long. And we can write this kind of directly as what our condition for the while will be something reflecting this statement here. So we're going to add something to this, which is waiting readers not equal zero. And, and we haven't waited too long, that sort of thing. We're going to modify this part of the condition to handle that here. And for read locks, previously we would be waiting until there's no writers, but now we want to wait until there's no writers and there's no writers who've waited too long. Because if there's writers who waited too long, we want to let them go. They can't go if we acquire the read lock. So we're going to change this to, and no too long waiting writers, and we're going to change this to and haven't waited too long. And when we change these conditions, that means this has to match how we signal or broadcast. So we need to think about, does it change what we're checking before we signal or broadcast? And here, this is going to change, or another writer has waited too long, to match our condition up here. Yeah. Long. And here, we ought want to here I'm signaling probably too often. This should be readers equals zero and waiting readers equals zero or another writer has waited too long. So we want to change this condition. And I forgot the readers equals zero part of it in the original code, which was a mistake. Okay, so questions about this answer? Okay, so finally, we're going to talk about Another problem with threads, which we're probably going to have to finish up next Tuesday before we move on to virtual memory. And I'm going to illustrate this problem with a different example. So let's say we have here a one-way bridge, we have two cars going on the bridge, and we want to use something like locks to reserve sections of the road to, you know, make us have some consistent idea of, you know, who should get to go when. And you might say, well, let's just, you know, have each car, let's just say we'll reserve for it the section of road just ahead of it. We'll just say our rule is that this is reserved for you as if you, like, acquired a mutex lock for it. So, okay, this car has this section of road reserved. This car has this section of road reserved. And we're going to follow this rule that we're not going to let anyone else use that section of road while it's reserved. So they take advantage of that. And here we are. We are kind of can't go anywhere. You know, and if our rule is that we're going to reserve the little section of road ahead of us, well, you know, we can't reserve it now. It's not available. We can't get that lock. Like, if this was a region we wanted to lock, well, this is reserved by, you know, the yellow car wants to get this car region reserved by the black car. Well, it's locked. Can't get it. It's going to be waiting for it. And this black car wants to use the part of the road that's being used by the yellow car. Can't get it. It's waiting for it. And what the situation is that, you know, the black car is waiting on the yellow car. And the yellow car is waiting on the black car. And we're going to call this situation a deadlock. That if everyone's just waiting for the other person, then we're not going to make any progress. And in the real world, we have a solution to this, which is that someone is going to have to give up and, you know, not try to keep going. And, well, in the real world, we resolve it that way. But if we're thinking about this sort of as code, well, our code is not going to do that unless we wrote some statement to, like, have that option. And we're going to think about where this occurs in sort of threaded examples, and we're going to go through some as we finish up today. And we're actually going to learn that our main strategy for worrying about this, someone waiting for someone to do something who's also waiting for you to do something, is to prevent this sort of cycle from existing in the first place. And we'll talk about that probably next time. But let's, you know, I have this sort of artificial example where we can see we have this mutual waiting. But does this happen in real programs? And the answer is yes. We saw an example earlier in the semester, which was this deadlock problem. That here I have a child trying to write stuff to the parent. And what we said is that we have a pipe from the child to the parent. And this write operation would fill in this pipe and start wait for space. Parent. And similarly, the parent to child operation is going to wait for space child. And you might say, well, they're waiting for space, and they're waiting for space because they're waiting for the read operation. This right here is their, I should draw this in a consistent color. This right here, you know, is waiting for this read that the parent's going to do, and the parent's write is waiting for the same read, for the corresponding read the child's going to do, but neither the parent or the child are going to do that read until later on, until after they're done waiting for the other one. So we have this sort of cycle of waiting. The child's waiting for the pipe to have free buffer space, but that's not going to happen until the parent reads. The parent's not going to read because it's waiting for free buffer space. That's not going to be available until the child reads. So we have this cycle of waiting. And this sort of graph structure is how we'll often picture these sort of dependency situations, that our child, our parent process is waiting for space to write on one buffer that needs to be read by the child, but the child is not reading it right now because it's waiting for space to write on the other buffer, which the parent is not reading right now for the same reason. We're stuck in this loop, and we need to do something to break that. Now, when I sort of introduced this idea, I kind of gave the impression that we'd be talking about locks. So let's do an example with locks. So here I have a function which moves a file. You know, we're tracking files like we might in OS, and we track them by having this data structure representing a directory, which has like a tree map or a hash map, something like that, of directory entries, which are string mapped to a directory entry. And this move file operation takes two directories, and we want to make sure that we lock properly, so no one like sees a directory that, you know, is, you know, in the middle of being changed. That would cause some inconsistency. And so I lock the from directory, then lock the to directory, and then I do the move operation modifying both of them, then unlock them. And thread one here, let's say we're moving A to B, the file foo, and B to A, the file bar. It seems like we should be able to do both of these at the same time. And we'll have the situation where sometimes this will work and sometimes it won't. And this is the most sort of common deadlock-like situation that we see in the real world. And it's kind of analogous to our bridge problem, that this deadlock here, where everyone was waiting for each other, only happens when these two cars happen to arrive at the same time. And we're going to see that same thing here, that we're going to have a problem when these two threads are trying to do this operation at the same time and not otherwise. So if they arrive at different times, well, thread one goes, then thread two goes, and it's fine. And even if they overlap a little, it could also be fine, because if thread two arrives, say, when thread one, you know, has the B lock here, then that's fine, because thread two is going to wait until thread one finishes, and we're great. Where we're going to run into a problem is if thread two starts here. So let's see what happens. Is that, you know, thread one's going to reserve its equivalent of the piece of road in front of it and say, okay, I need A for myself, got it. Thread B is going to reserve its equivalent of the piece of road in front of it. I need B, the, you know, the equivalent of the right side of the road. And then they're going to try to reserve the next piece of road conceptually, or the other directory. And they're both going to be waiting because they're waiting for each other. And they're going to keep waiting for each other because they're waiting for someone to release a lock that they're never going to release because they have to stop waiting first. Sort of this is our classical deadlock situation with locks. I can draw our same graph we saw before to kind of illustrate this, that, you know, what ends up happening is thread one is waiting for a lock on directory B, but that lock is held by and therefore must be released by thread two, but thread two is not going to do that until it's done waiting for the lock on directory A that thread one holds, and there's just no way of breaking up this situation without sort of having this code be different. We have to change something about the move file method to stop this from happening. And I've shown this example with two threads and two calls to move file, but we can also have the same sort of thing happen with three threads and three calls to move file. You know, where we end up with, you know, three-way waiting. So we're going to want to think of a general solution and sort of we're going to look for, you know, what's common about both of these situations that we can use to deal with this scenario. But just wanted to keep in mind, it's not always one thread waits on another, just two threads, even though that's the most common situation. So, okay. And I guess we'll finish up. Yeah. Okay. So we can also have the same sort of thing happen with other things that wait for resources. So for example, let's say instead of malloc crashing when there's not space, it just waited for space. In that case, we could end up with the same kind of deadlock of waiting for each other, where thread one is waiting for more space to be available, and thread two is waiting for more space to be available, and they're effectively waiting for each other, even though this is very indirect, because thread one's basically waiting for thread two to release this 1 megabyte it allocated, and the same thing for thread two. So this is the general idea of deadlock, and next time we'll talk about sort of how we can avoid deadlock. Because, you know, obviously we don't want our program just randomly hanging, so we're going to need to design our method so it just basically so it never happens. Okay, so I'll take questions before I sign off.